From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
Imagine, if you will, that the most frightening things on Earth are about to come out of the darkness. They will look surprisingly like your neighbors, your friends, your family.
This situation must be controlled before it's too late. They are multiplying too rapidly.
Now accept the fact that there's no escaping the awful consequences.
We've got to survive. Somebody's got to survive.
When there is no more room in hell, the dead will walk the earth.
That's a clip from a radio commercial for George A. Romero's classic zombie film, Dawn of the Dead. We'll explore the cinema of the undead today as we look at the horror genre. We'll also listen to some classic horror shows from the golden age of radio and meet writer Kelly Link, who describes her fiction as kitchen sink magical realism. But first, Andrew Davidson has just released his debut novel. It's called The Gargoyle, and it's been described as an inferno for our time. Davidson spoke to Steve Paulson about The Gargoyle, but before they chatted, Davidson read an excerpt from the graphic and gruesome beginning of The Gargoyle, in which the unnamed protagonist's car crashes into a ravine.
Just as I was beginning my drift into unconsciousness, there was the explosion. Not a movie explosion, but a small, real-life explosion, like the ignition of an unhappy gas oven that holds a grudge against its owner. A flash of blue flame skittered across the roof of the car, which was at a slanted angle underneath my dangling body. Out of my nose crawled a drop of blood, which jumped expectantly into the happy young flame springing to life beneath me. I could feel my hair catch fire. Then I could smell it. My flesh began to singe, as if I were a scrap of meat newly thrown onto the barbecue, and then I could hear the bubbling of my skin as the flames kissed it. I could not reach my head to extinguish my flaming hair. My arms would not respond to my commands. I imagine, dear reader, that you've had some experience with heat. Perhaps you've tipped a boiling kettle at the wrong angle, and the steam crept up your sleeve. Or, in a youthful dare, you held a match between your fingers for as long as you could. Hasn't everyone, at least once, filled the bathtub with overly hot water and forgot to dip in a toe before committing the whole foot? If you've only had these kinds of minor incidents, I want you to imagine something new. Imagine turning on one of the elements of your stove. Let's say it's the electric kind with black coils on top. Don't put a pot of water on the element, because the water only absorbs the heat and uses it to boil. Maybe some tiny tendrils of smoke curl up from a previous spill on the burner. A slight violet tinge will appear, nestled there in the black rings, and then the element assumes some reddish-purple tones, like unripe blackberries. It moves towards orange and finally, an intense glowing red. Kind of beautiful, isn't it? Now, lower your head so that your eyes are even with the top of the stove, and you can peer through the shimmering waves rising up. Think of those old movies where the hero finds himself looking across the desert at an unexpected oasis. I want you to trace the fingertips of your left hand gently across your right palm, noting the way your skin registers even the lightest touch. If someone else were doing it, you might even be turned on. Now, slam that sensitive, responsive hand directly onto that glowing element. And hold it there. Hold it there as the element scorches Dante's nine rings right into your palm, allowing you to grasp hell in your hand forever. Let the heat engrave the skin, the muscles, the tendons. Let it smolder down to the bone. Wait for the burn to embed itself so far into you that you don't know if you'll ever be able to let go of that coil. It won't be long until the stench of your own burning flesh wafts up, grabbing your nose hairs and refusing to let go, and you smell your body burn. I want you to keep that hand pressed down for a slow count of 60. No cheating. 1, Mississippi. 2, Mississippi. 3, Mississippi. At 60, Mississippi. Your hand will have melted so that it now surrounds the element, becoming fused with it. Now, rip your flesh free. I have another task for you. Lean down, turn your head to one side, and slap your cheek on the same element. I'll let you choose which side of your face. Again, 60 Mississippis, no cheating. The convenient thing is that your ear is right there to capture the snap, crackle, and pop of your flesh. Now you might have some idea of what it was like for me to be pinned inside that car, unable to escape the flames, conscious enough to catalog the experience until I went into shock. There were a few short and merciful moments in which I could hear and smell and think, still documenting everything but feeling nothing. Why does this no longer hurt? I remember closing my eyes and wishing for complete, beautiful blackness. I remember thinking that I should have lived my life as a vegetarian. Then the car shifted once more, tipping over into the creek upon whose edge it had been teetering, like the turtle had regained its feet and scurried into the nearest water source. This occurrence, the car falling into the creek, saved my life by extinguishing the flames and cooling my newly broiled flesh.
Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you. Now, that is quite a graphic scene. Did you worry at all about scaring off your readers or simply going over the top?
No, I never really worried about that at all because I never really expected to have any readers other than myself, as this was the first novel that I was ever working on, and I'd already been working on my writing for, I don't know, 15, 18 years, something like that. I'd reached the point that I did nothing but write to amuse myself.
Which I guess says something about what kind of amusements you search after.
Well, you know, we do get to like a little bit more lighter fare later in the book, of course, too. I have a range of things that amuse me.
Well, what inspired you to write this book, The Gargoyle?
Well, inspire is kind of a funny word because I'm not really somebody who gets inspiration, per se. I tend to write every night. I sit down, same time, same place, at a desk that is empty and facing a wall that's bare and a little bit of music on in the background, but no English lyrics. And I sweat out ideas. Things tend not to come in inspiration for me. That said, this book did come with inspiration, and that was the lead female character, Marianne Engel, who arrived into my life in the spring of 2000 and started jabbing and pestering and bugging me until I consented to write a book in which she could exist.
So you turned her into a fictional character.
I did. Well, she came and she had the look that she ends up with in the book and arrived with her full name, and she was saying things that she insisted were stories I had to write down, and I didn't really have too much choice.
So how would you describe the story of The Gargoyle?
In my estimation, it's a very unconventional romance. A romance between damaged people, which I think is always more interesting than what people may call, quote, unquote, you know, normal people. It's the story of a severely burned pornographer who, while recovering in the hospital, encounters a sculptress of gargoyles who may or may not be schizophrenic, who insists that they were lovers in medieval Germany.
So it's a story that invokes past lives.
It does, and it gets around a little bit more than just medieval Germany as well. We get back to Viking-era Iceland and Victorian England and ancient Japan and Italy during the Black Plague. It's a book that likes to travel.
Now, the idea of reincarnation is one of the major themes in your novel. What is it about reincarnation that you find so intriguing?
Well, it's not even necessarily so much reincarnation. I think that it's even a little bit open-ended whether these are lives being repeated or a life that is ongoing. I think it's more than reincarnation, the idea of a love that never dies that intrigues me in this book.
What your book does is it sort of raises this possibility of people who live for a very long time, who've lived in medieval times, and there is, it would seem, a trip into hell, sort of modeled after Dante's Inferno. Did you have to work out a whole metaphysical system to be able to write this story?
I believe that I did. I mean, I never really scratched out a, you know, metaphysical system. Here is the universe. But after a while, I worked on this for many, many years, you develop a feeling for what violates the internal logic of the story. And I had to write a lot of things that didn't belong, that conflicted with what I was trying to get across, and take them out before I really realized, okay, this is the universe that this story is occurring in, because it's pretty similar to ours, but I think it's just a one step outside.
And what made you want to create characters that have lived for centuries, perhaps reincarnated, perhaps not? Why was that such a compelling idea to you?
Well, actually, I never began with that idea at all. I had no agenda for my characters. I knew that I was starting with this character of Marianne Engel, who, you know, appeared to me in kind of this waking vision and wouldn't leave me alone. When she appeared, I knew that she wouldn't be telling the story because of the nature of her personality. Her character wouldn't allow her to be the narrator, so I had a need to create a narrator. And a lot of thought and time and effort went into creating these characters, their backstories, their life histories. I would write diary entries by them. I'd, you know, make lists of their favorite things. And I know that I'm writing well when they start doing things that I never see coming. And I write out a scene and I go, well, okay, this is very interesting. This is strange. Why are they doing this? And trusting it enough to let it go. And then being able to look back in a couple of days and go, oh, okay, that does make sense with the character because of this thing that happened to them when they were 11 years old, or because of an idea that they hold dear that they've written about in their diary. So it's not necessarily that I had an idea that I wanted to enact through the characters. For me, it always starts with the characters and just following them and listening to them wherever they might lead me.
Now, there's a sense that your characters often have a certain destiny that they need to fulfill. I guess I wonder if you yourself believe in fate.
That is the big question, isn't it? I would say I'm probably more of a free will guy than a fate guy. But it really doesn't matter what I believe. I think it's what the characters believe, of course. Are you a free will guy or a fate guy?
I think I'm more of a free will guy, too.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if I said free wheel or free will, but anyway.
But whatever it was, you chose. You made the choice to say it.
Right, yes. I have to ask you about Dante's Inferno, which is clearly an influence on this book, and you have sort of your own Inferno scene as well. What is it that you find so compelling about that story?
Well, if you're going to have an influence, Dante's a pretty good one to have. What I find most compelling about it is that it is, at this point, actually a part of the Western consciousness. Like, if you walk out onto the street, you walk out of the radio station after we're finished this interview, and you stop somebody on the street and you say, have you heard of Dante? Probably they have. If you ask them if they've read the Divine Comedy, chances of that are quite a bit less. But if you ask them to tell you what they think hell looks like, they're going to come back with something that's probably pretty much straight out of Inferno. And the narrator actually talks about this in the book, and it's something that I do agree with him on, is that it's one of those books that people almost don't even have to read, Inferno in particular, because they already know it, even if they don't know it. Don't get me wrong, I'm not advocating not reading Dante. If I can spur a few people to go out and go back to the source material, wonderful, because it's unbelievably good.
And are you attracted to the idea of different levels of hell? You kind of descend as the sin gets greater?
I'm attracted to the idea that the sin fits the sinner, and that the sinner basically chooses their own punishment. I find that a very, very compelling idea.
Well, tell me about your own version of hell, which may or may not be a hallucination in your story.
My own version of hell?
Isn't it fair to say that your narrator visits hell at one point?
Yeah. In fact, I would say that he travels not only through one, but I think four different versions of it. Again, if we go with the idea of the hell, the punishment fitting the sinner, Okay, my idea of hell then would be to be sitting somewhere in an empty room for eternity and a head full of ideas and no paper or pen available.
A writer has spoken.
Yeah.
Andrew Davidson is the author of The Gargoyle. He spoke with Steve Paulson. Davidson lives in Winnipeg, Manitoba. What are you afraid of? We'd love to hear from you. You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. It's always nice to hear from you. Coming up, Terror on the Air, the golden age of horror radio and zombie movies, as we continue to explore horror. I'm Jim Fleming. It's to the best of our knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Richard Hand is the author of Terror on the Air, Horror Radio in America, 1931 to 1952. The book chronicles the popularity of the horror genre during the golden age of radio. Hand is a longtime fan of horror radio.
I've always been fascinated with the horror potential of radio. I think Stephen King said nothing can make it real like radio in relation to horror. But I suppose what I like listening to the old recordings is you can tell they're live. You can tell that there's adrenaline running through all the performers. And also, I suppose because radio is an oral medium, not a visual medium, you can explore things like claustrophobia and pitch blackness in a way that film or television never could.
Lights out, everybody. Is later than you think.
Lights Out started broadcasting in Chicago in the mid-1930s and was started by a great radio writer and director called Willis Cooper. But it really came into its own when Arch Obler, a very young talent, took over the show. And he really made it his own. He was a great showman, and apparently descriptions of how he was as a director are evidence to that. But it really did explore the potential of horror, with enormous fun as well. But some of the plays really did push the limits. Being on the boundary of science fiction and horror, they really exploited the dimensions of sound and soundscape. Arch Obler was a great wunderkind in radio, really, a great young discovery. In fact, I think the form of radio was so new, it did attract numerous great talents, others being Orson Welles. But Arch Obler is one of those front runners of the great radio talent. And what he did with Lights Out was he really explored the horror potential of the show. But he also did explore the science fiction element and also the great humour. And what's amazing with listening to some of those old plays is how they play around with the form in a way that we might associate with movies now like Scream and those kind of postmodern self-referential horror films. Arch Obler was doing it in the 30s with Lights Out. In Lights Out, there's a couple of plays where Arch Obler does refer to himself. He becomes a character within the plays himself, and it's enormous fun when he does that.
We'll start out next week's play with a regular Lights Out opening. Lights Out, everybody, chimes, later than you think, gone. First character is named Hellman. Call him Hellman. Jack Hellman, H-E-L-M-N. Who else? Got that?
Mm-hmm.
He commits a murder and he, Oh, what's the use? I can't write another one of these things. Ghosts and groans and blood. I tell you, I can't do it. I can't do it.
Mr. Obler.
Also, what he does with some of these plays are real dark rides. They're real roller coaster rides. It's a play called Poltergeist, which is a very chilling work, but it's enormous fun. It's a real kind of ghost train ride of a show. Three young American tourists are travelling in the countryside, and one of them dies, and gradually you realise how they're under threat, and there's supernatural occurrences, and the pace is terrific, the way it builds up.
This is where we are, Florida. Yes, I hear you. I hear you. Where are you? Where are you? No! No!
The episode Chicken Heart and Lights Out is one of the great classics of horror radio. It was first broadcast in 1938, actually a few months before War of the Worlds, interestingly enough. And what happens in Chicken Heart, it's a great example of science fiction. A couple of scientists take a chicken heart, still beating, and begin to do experiments on it, and it begins to expand exponentially. So it gets larger and larger and larger until it engulfs the whole world, hard as that may be to believe. It's actually a terrifying concept. Because it's a pounding heart, you get the sound of the heartbeat thumping through the work, and that's no doubt part of its great effect.
You ask for the National Guard. I say call out the entire army. Blast this thing off the earth.
All ready, Chief. Pumpers are ready. All hoses coupled up. We'll flood that thing with water from all angles.
All right, here's the signal. Open them up! Full blast!
Chief, look out! That flash, it's reaching out!
Get back, everybody! Everybody, back!
The fools, what good is water? I told them, the only hope is artillery. Bombs.
I think what radio can do with the use of sound and soundscapes, and something very simple like the sound of a heartbeat, it can lend a real atmosphere to work of film, TV or theatre. But in radio, it can really encapsulate. And that's why there's numerous fantastic adaptations of Edgar Allan Poe's The Telltale Heart. Even though radio was invented long after Edgar Allan Poe died, some of his stories were just waiting for the invention of radio, because that simple sound effect of a pounding heart is terrific to create a kind of horror world in the imagination of the listener.
The flesh is already engulfing the guns. They came too late.
Some of the horror radio shows like Lights Out and Suspense made the transition over to television. They did so quite successfully, even though there'd perhaps be different personnel involved. It was a new era for them. But another great show was Inner Sanctum Mysteries, which was one of the great trademarks of radio, was its creaking door at the beginning.
Friends of the creaking door. This is your host to welcome you once again into the inner sanctum. Come on in for the crime of your lives.
Now that did translate onto the television screen where you had a cobwebby door that still creaked open, but perhaps not quite with the same power as that sound of the creaking door. But some of those shows made that transition. And also, I think the influence of horror radio has in some ways been overlooked. I think it's enormously important. People like Stephen King would admit how important it was. But you can also see the influence on EC comics like Tales from the Crypt and things like that, that you can tell that the artists and writers of stories were listening to those fantastic horror radio plays that were being broadcast live. Stephen King is probably quite right to celebrate Arch Oboler as the great figure in horror radio, but there are numerous other figures. I think what Arch Oboler did brilliantly was his showmanship. He was a great personality. You hear at the beginning of some of the existing Lights Out recordings the way he talks to the audience. He really is in his medium as a performer as much as a writer and director.
This is Arch Oboler bringing you another in our series of Stories of the Unusual. And once again, we caution you. These Lights Out stories are definitely not for the timid soul. So we tell you calmly and very sincerely, if you frighten easily, turn off your radio now.
I think horror radio suffered the fate of a lot of radio drama, certainly in the United States, which was it was superseded by television. One feels that there was an investment suddenly in TV and less so in radio. And those days of live radio broadcasting disappeared quite quickly. Also, I think pre-recording came in and that changed things somewhat. Interestingly, elsewhere in the world, like on the BBC in Britain, radio drama has continued ever since, with BBC still producing over 300 radio plays a year, or whatever the facts are for that. And horror has always had an important place. The Dark House was a great example of the potential of contemporary horror radio. With this particular play, if you listened on the web, you could choose which character to follow. So it was a kind of ghost story, but you could choose which character you'd follow, whether they were outside or inside the house. So that sense of interactivity was enormous fun, and it does show the potential, I think, for horror radio still. It was somewhere between a good old-fashioned live horror show, but also a digital game or something like that, because that element of the audience being involved and making decisions. I really think there's great potential for renaissance of horror radio, or perhaps not so much horror radio as horror listening. I think the whole podcasting culture has had enormous impact, and it seems like spoken word dramas and the spoken word form continues to be popular. Also, there's certain writers like Neil Gaiman. I'm aware that on his website he's done some readings of his own horror fiction. So there's that kind of potential, and I think there's people listening for it. People don't just want to listen to music. They may want to listen to drama, and horror culture has never gone away.
Richard Hand is the author of Terror on the Air, Horror Radio in America, 1931 to 1952. Glenn Kaye is the author of Zombie Movies, The Ultimate Guide. In the book, Kaye reviews and rates almost 300 zombie films, including the movie that Kaye says is the very first zombie film, White Zombie. It was released in 1932.
Bela Lugosi, who is the villain, is a plantation owner, and he does use the zombies as workers on his plantation, which in Haitian folklore is what zombies were used for as well. But he also has his own kind of nefarious plan to steal a woman away from the hero, who was just recently married, and so he uses his voodoo skills to, you know, hypnotize people and murder them, and uses zombies as sort of muscle to try and kill off the hero.
There aren't any movies that have nice zombies in them, are there?
Not a lot, but there are. Eventually, you do get a few sympathetic zombies. There's a Lita Romero movie from 1985 called Day of the Dead, which deals with one of the zombies, Bub, who they try to train, domesticate, basically. And it doesn't completely work, but he does show a more human side to him, some memories of his past life, Those sorts of things.
We can't really talk about zombie movies without discussing George Romero's 1968 classic, Night of the Living Dead. It's probably the most famous zombie film of all time, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And it's also the one that really officially altered the perception of what a zombie was from
what do you mean?
The earlier films. Well, the zombies in Romero's Night of the Living Dead took on ghoulish characteristics. You know, they weren't just mindless muscle for an evil scientist to take over the world. They just had a singular craving for flesh, and so they would basically just en masse attack corpses eating on the flesh of still living humans, and they didn't serve any voodoo master.
The body should be disposed of at once, preferably by cremation. The bodies must be carried to the street and burned. They must be burned immediately. Soak them with gasoline and burn them. The bereaved will have to forego the dubious comforts that a funeral service will give. They're just dead flesh and dangerous.
They were essentially undead ghouls.
Zombies up until this time were slaves, essentially.
Yes.
The creatures of some overseeing mind.
Exactly.
Night of the Living Dead, they took on some sort of vampire characteristics, too, and they passed it on, right?
Absolutely. I believe the filmmaker, Jorge Romero, based his story on Richard Matheson's I Am Legend, which actually was a vampire book.
Right.
But he adapted it and decided that the zombies would take on more some of the characteristics of the vampire, but he changed essentially the rules of what a zombie had been previously.
It's an interesting thing because Matheson's book is told all from the perspective of the sole human survivor, but you actually, in the course of the book, begin to have some sympathy for the vampires in his story. And I suppose that's true for some of the zombies in films that came after that as well.
Absolutely. In particular, his latest movies, Land of the Dead, the zombies are very sympathetic. In fact, I believe there was an interview where he said you should actually be rooting for the zombies.
I'm still curious about Night of the Living Dead, because I know that it's one of your favorite movies, the zombie movies of all time. Are there scenes in it that you especially like? Is there one favorite scene you have from Night of the Living Dead?
Boy, okay. There are several iconic scenes. I think that the film broke a lot of taboos, so that in itself makes it interesting. There are shots of zombies. I've even got a still in the book, shot of zombies approaching a house, and one of them's naked, and another one's eating a mouse. And this is all stuff you couldn't show in movies up to that point. And I don't even believe that had a major distributor picked up the film for release, that they would have been able to release the film with a suitable rating without it having been edited and cut.
Was there another scene you wanted to talk about from Night of the Living Dead?
To be honest, Night of the Living Dead is my number two movie. Dawn of the Dead is my favorite.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What is it about Dawn of the Dead that you think makes it a superior zombie film?
Those two, they flip-flop in a lot of people's minds. Even though Night is very scary, and it's just personal preference, I tend to enjoy films that have a little bit of humor and a little bit of satire. Dawn of the Dead has a really, a fun message about consumerism, and he makes a more effective point that way. It's less jokey. I shouldn't say that. It's less preachy is what I mean to say. He uses a lot of humor to get his ideas across. And in the process, he creates a lot of interesting-looking zombies, some of which are silly. I can picture several of the zombies moving around that have different costumes and whatnot. In the first movie, they're just people in ragged clothing, but he gets a little more elaborate in the other movies.
Who did Dawn of the Dead?
Dawn of the Dead is also George Romero.
Yeah.
That was the sequel to Night of the Living Dead.
You think he learned from the first one and created a better one?
I think so. I think he had more money, he had more resources, he could tell a bigger story. And again, I like that it is scary. There are a lot of disturbing things happening in the film, but it's also got a really black sense of humor. And the ideas and themes that he's dealing with, he doesn't hit you over the head with them.
What the hell are they?
They're us, that's all. There's no more room in hell.
What?
Something my granddaddy used to tell us. You know Mukumbo? Voodoo. Granddad was a priest in Trinidad. He used to tell us, when there's no more room in hell, the dead will walk the earth.
What's the strangest zombie film you've ever seen?
There are some odd ones, to be sure.
It's a funny question to ask, isn't it? Because in a way, I mean, all zombie films are strange. I mean, I was looking through some of these, and there are kung fu zombie movies, for instance.
You know what? That probably is the strangest. It's just unusual because in Hong Kong, being a British colony, they get a lot of Hammer films like Horror of Dracula and Plague of the Zombies. And the cinematic zombie equivalent in Hong Kong is sort of a mishmash of Chinese mythology and the Hammer horror films. So you've got these what are essentially corpses that hop. And this is it's a combination of taking, you know, zombie from Plague of the Zombies, and then in China, apparently the country being so large, a lot of people worked away from their homes. And if they were to die, they needed to be buried on their home soil. And so there would be these Taoist priests who would resurrect and then lead the dead bodies back home so they could be buried, and these bodies would hop. And all of these movies that deal with this they're very unusual. They're highly entertaining. They're very high energy. And the Chinese being, I don't want to generalize, but you know, obviously Hong Kong and Chinese films feature martial arts to a large degree. A lot of them like to combine the martial arts and the zombies together.
Yeah. What is it about zombies? I mean, they're all over now. They're part of the zeitgeist, I suppose you'd say, not just in movies, but books and video games. What is it about zombies that makes them so appealing?
They've never been so popular as they have been recently. At least in my lifetime, they've never been so popular right now. And I guess it's interesting. A lot of these new movies, they're really dealing with viruses seem to be a big theme. I don't know if perhaps that's what scares people today.
In the 50s, it was the atom bomb, and now it's the Ebola virus.
Exactly. And the film's 28 days later and 28 weeks later, I was lucky enough to speak with a crew member, and he told me that basically all this is it's a movie about the Ebola virus with zombies. They followed, you know, what would happen during an Ebola outbreak. They basically took zombies and added the whole Ebola strain to it. The zombies, they spit up this bile which infects people, and it's exactly the same as what an Ebola virus does.
Wow.
And how it is transferred. There have been a lot of horrible natural disasters recently, and we've seen frighteningly how quickly law and order can break down, and I think that's a really scary and frightening idea, and I think a lot of recent films are using it.
Scary and frightening, but in a way comforting if we can blame it on the zombies, right?
Absolutely. And it also, I mean, ultimately, and although a lot of the films do have a dark ending, not all of them do. In fact, Land of the Dead has a surprisingly upbeat ending for a Romero film. It's a way of, I guess, dealing with some horrible events. And even though terrible things are occurring on screen, you're going to make it out alive. You're going to survive. So ultimately, you're dealing with it in your own personal way.
Yeah. So what do you think the future is for zombie movies? Are they going to evolve into something different, or will we always have zombies?
Even the early zombies, they still pop up now and again. Films like Serpent in the Rainbow, which was, again, dealing with Haitian zombies, they never all totally disappear. But I do think, yeah, there will be evolutionary steps depending on whatever events are occurring around us in the world. I don't know, maybe there'll be Wall Street zombies soon or... Seeing as the stock market seems to be a little iffy right now.
Well, that's a really frightening thought. I'm not sure we should go there.
But whatever people are afraid of, that these zombies are so malleable that you can take whatever topical event is frightening to people, and you can mush it together and make something that's frightening and hopefully entertaining, but that has some subtext to it as well, if it's well done. Not all of them are well done, but if it's well done.
Glenn Kay is the author of Zombie Movies, The Ultimate Guide. And you? Do you have a favorite zombie movie? Favorite horror film or novel? We'd love to know what it is. You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. Coming up, the delightfully disturbing fiction of Kelly Link as we conclude our hour on horror. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Time magazine describes the fiction of Kelly Link as a place few writers go, a netherworld between literature and fantasy, Alice Munro and J.K. Rowling. Kelly Link's new short story collection is called Pretty Monsters. Although it's her third collection, it's the first to be aimed at young adults. Adults of any age are sure to enjoy Link's fiction. Kelly Link talked with Anne Strainchamps about the difference between writing for young adults and not-so-young adults.
I suppose there's a difference. A lot of the stories I originally wrote for young adult anthologies of ghost stories or anthologies of modern fairy tales that were specifically for children. There's actually some overlap between the first two collections and Pretty Monsters. There are three stories, all of which originally I had in my head as I was writing them, that they were stories that I would have enjoyed when I was, say, 14 or 15.
Of course, a lot of the characters in the stories are teenagers themselves.
Yes.
Is that an age you especially like writing about?
You know, I've heard people say that every writer has an age, a specific time period that they're drawn to write about. And this may be a historical moment in time that you find yourself coming back to over and over again. I'm drawn to stories in which a character is experiencing something for the first time, in which they're entering into a new world. It might be a fantastic landscape, or it might be a new kind of situation that they haven't encountered before. And there's a mesh between that kind of storytelling and the kinds of stories that young adults like, obviously.
Hmm. Well, a great many of your characters encounter situations that are definitely out of the normal. We should start by talking maybe about the first story in this collection called The Wrong Grave. Will you tell us about that one?
Sure. This is a story that I wanted to write for a long time. There's a story, a true story, about the poet Dante Gabriel Rossetti, who buried his poetry with his long-term partner. In fact, I think they were married, and these were the only copies of the poems that he had. And at a certain point, he dug her back up in order to retrieve the poetry, which is a story that's always really stuck with me. And I also wanted to write a story that was a fairy tale in a way, about a guy who does something and encounters a supernatural being and has to get out of that sticky situation that he's gotten himself into. And so in my story, it's a teenage boy who wants to be a poet, who has done the same thing that Dante Gabriel Rossetti has done. He's buried his poetry with his dead girlfriend. And so he goes and he digs it up. And gets into trouble.
It's got a great beginning. Could you read just the first paragraph of it?
Sure. All of this happened because a boy I once knew named Miles Sperry decided to go into the resurrectionist business and dig up the grave of his girlfriend, Bethany Baldwin, who had been dead for not quite a year. Miles planned to do this in order to recover the sheaf of poems he had and what he'd felt was a beautiful and romantic gesture put into her casket. Or possibly it had just been a really dumb thing to do. He hadn't made copies. Miles had always been impulsive. I think you should know that right up front. He tucked the poems, handwritten, tear-stained and with crossouts, under Bethany's hands. Her fingers had felt like candles, fat and waxy and pleasantly cool until you remembered that they were fingers. And he couldn't help noticing that there was something wrong about her breasts. They seemed larger. If Bethany had known that she was going to die, would she have gone all the way with him? One of his poems was about that, about how now they never would, how it was too late now. Carpe diem before you run out of diem.
You know, this is both an outlandish premise, and yet somehow it seems perfectly in keeping with a teenager. You know, it's that self-absorption.
Well, these are fun characters to inhabit when you write a story because the responses are sometimes very large. You know, teenagers are given to dramatic gestures, and yet you sort of sympathize with them because even as an adult, you remember being a teenager and you remember having these outsized emotions.
Yeah, and poor Miles thinks he's going to be a great poet and, you know, he needs to rescue his poems for posterity. So things go rather spectacularly bad for him once he digs up his girlfriend's grave because, well, for one thing, it turns out he's dug up what seems to be the wrong girl. I wondered if you could read a bit of the section where he discovers his mistake.
Sure. I'm reading the section in which the adolescent poet Miles has successfully, with the aid of a special shovel, dug up the coffin of the girl that he thinks is his girlfriend. And in fact, it turns out that he's not only dug up the wrong grave, but when he gets the lid open, it turns out that the wrong dead girl in there is a little bit more lively than you might expect. The wrong dead girl spoke first. "Knock, knock," she said. "What?" Miles said. "Knock, knock," the wrong dead girl said again. "Who's there?" Miles said. "Gloria," the wrong dead girl said. "Gloria Palnick, who are you, and what are you doing in my grave?" "This isn't your grave," Miles said, aware that he was arguing with a dead girl, and the wrong dead girl at that. "This is Bethany's grave. What are you doing in Bethany's grave?" "Oh, no," Gloria Palnick said. "This is my grave, and I get to ask the questions." A notion crept like little dead cat feet over Miles. Possibly he had made a dangerous and deeply embarrassing mistake. "Poetry," he managed to say. "There was some poetry that I accidentally left in my girlfriend's casket, and there's a deadline for a poetry contest coming up, and so I really, really needed to get it back." The dead girl stared at him. There was something about her hair that Miles didn't like. "Excuse me, but are you for real?" she said. "This sounds like one of those lame excuses. The dog ate my homework. I accidentally buried my poetry with my dead girlfriend." "Look," Miles said, "I checked the tombstone and everything. This is supposed to be Bethany's grave, Bethany Baldwin. I'm really sorry I bothered you and everything, but this really isn't my fault." The dead girl just stared at him thoughtfully. He wished that she would blink. She wasn't smiling anymore. Her hair, lank and black, where Bethany's had been brownish and frizzy in summer, was writhing a little, like snakes. Miles thought of centipedes, inky midnight tentacles. "Maybe I should just go away," Miles said, "leave you to rest in peace or whatever." "I don't think sorry cuts the mustard here," Gloria Palnick said. She barely moved her mouth when she spoke, Miles noticed, and yet her enunciation was fine. "Besides, I'm sick of this place. It's boring. Maybe I'll just come along with."
I can't tell who I like better, Miles or the dead girl.
I'm very fond of both of them. Miles does some very impulsive, sort of thoughtless things. But I'm certainly sympathetic to anybody who values poetry so highly, even if it's his own poetry.
Poor Miles. The dead girl turns out to be remarkably difficult to get rid of, too.
Well, this is what happens when you get into a sticky situation with somebody. It's hard to disentangle yourself, especially if they have a lot of hair.
So another archetype of horror fiction, besides the graveyard setting we were talking about, is the scary campfire story. And that's a convention you play with in a story you wrote called Monster. Could you tell
Yes.
describe that one?
Monster is about a kid who is at a boys' summer camp and is not having a particularly good time. And they've gone hiking, and they're going to spend the night on a hill, Lookout Hill. And there have been reports from other campers of a monster on this hill. And, in fact, they do encounter the monster, which only sort of adds to the fact that the whole camping experience has not been a good one.
Well, in this particular story, you know, it's a horror story, so of course the monster that the kids in the other cabin have been scaring your kids with turns out to be real. Only since it's a Kelly Link story, it's not actually your everyday sort of monster. Could you read a bit about, you know, what happens when the monster shows up?
Sure. The monster had one Simpson twin under each arm. The twins were screaming. The monster threw them down the path. Then it bent over Brian Jones, who was lying half inside one of the tents, half in the snow. There were slurping noises. After a minute, it stood up again. It looked back and saw James Lorbeck. It waved. James Lorbeck shut his eyes. When he opened them again, the monster was standing over him. It had red eyes. It smelled like rotting fish and kerosene. It wasn't actually all that tall, the way you'd expect a monster to be tall. Except for that, it was even worse than Bungalow 4 had said. The monster stood and looked down and grinned. "You," it said. It had a voice like a dead tree full of bees, sweet and dripping and buzzing. It poked James on the shoulder with a long black nail. "What are you?" "I'm James Lorbeck," James said. "From Chicago?" The monster laughed. Its teeth were pointed and terrible. There was a smear of red on the dress where it had touched James. "You're the craziest thing I've ever seen. Look at that dress. Look at your hair. It's standing straight up. Is that mud? Why are you covered in mud?" "I was going to be a monster," James said. He swallowed. "No offense." "None taken," the monster said. "Wow, maybe I should go visit Chicago. I've never seen anything as funny as you. I could look at you for hours and hours, whenever I needed a laugh. You've really made my day, James Lorbeck." The snow was still falling. James shivered and shivered. His teeth were clicking together so loudly he thought they might break. "What are you doing here?" he said. "Where's Terrence? Did you do something to him?" Was he the guy who was down at the bottom of the hill, talking on a cell phone? "Yeah," James said. "Is he okay?" "He was talking to some girl named Darlene," the monster said. "I tried to talk to her, but she started screaming and it hurt my ears, so I hung up. Do you happen to know where she lives?" "Somewhere in Ohio," James said. "Thanks," the monster said. He took out a little black notebook and wrote something down. "What are you?" James said. "Who are you?" "I'm Angelina Jolie," the monster said. It blinked. James' heart almost stopped beating. "Really?" he said. "No," the monster said. "Just kidding."
I'm curious, the scary story, whether it's a ghost story or a, you know, classic horror story, it's been around for such a long time. What do you think is the perennial appeal? Why is it that we like to scare each other in stories?
I think being afraid in some ways is the same thing as falling in love. It's of a shorter duration, but there's the same charge as going out with somebody and realizing that you really, really like them. Reading a story and getting that frisson of terror is somehow very pleasurable, and it tends to be very individual, that things that might scare another reader are not necessarily going to scare me when I'm reading. In fact, you know, I'm not a big fan of movies like Saw. I would much rather watch a movie in which you never see the bad thing that happens. In fact, you're sort of straining to see it at the same time that you're hoping that you don't see it. I think that there's something that's hardwired in us that we get a certain kind of pleasure out of being a little bit afraid. And I don't think it's so much that, you know, when things are bad, that it's a relief to read a ghost story and have that same thing internalized. Because frankly, I like ghost stories when things are really good, when the economy is good, when there's somebody in the White House that I like. I still want to read a ghost story in the same way that I do when the economy is in the toilet. I have been told, though, by editors who have worked in publishing and by writers who write horror novels that in terms of popularity, that you can sort of trace publishing and see that when there's a Republican in the White House, that horror novels do really well. And when there's a Democrat in the White House, that mystery novels end up being the genre that sells the best.
And do you think there's a reason?
I don't know. I'm hoping to be able to chart this. I feel like horror has been on the rise for the last couple of years in publishing. You know, frankly, I wouldn't mind a couple of years in which people are really looking for mystery novels.
Kelly Link's new short story collection is called Pretty Monsters. She spoke with Anne Strange James. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like a copy of this hour, you can call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444 and ask for program number 928B, The Horror, The Horror. If you have questions or comments about the program, you can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This program was produced by Doug Gordon, with help from Mary Lou Finnegan, Anne Strange Champs, Charles Monroe Kane, and Veronica Rickert. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.